as I get myself together here. I'm doing this on purpose. I had some friends of mine who, I don't even know if they log in to even watch or pay attention to the lesson, but they watched just enough last week that they said, man, you look awful casual up there. Like, in fact, one of my friends, his name is Chris. Chris is a good friend. Chris says, I don't think I've seen you wear a tie in like 2 months, man. He's like, what's going on? He said, you look like Michael Jordan. Like, oh, and if you don't understand, like, old Michael Jordan, look it up. Old Michael Jordan dresses horrible. And they said, I look like old Michael Jordan. So I said, well, guess what? I'm going to put on a jacket. How about that? Right? That's as much as I can do. Especially in the summer when it gets a little hot. So here you go, Chris. Paul, you see it? Got on a jacket. He's like, how can you be a real preacher and you don't wear a jacket? Okay, so I have a jacket on. I feel official. It's authentic. But anyway, good morning again. We have been talking about both sacrifice and atonement and really understanding what atonement is and why it matters in a time like what we're experiencing when there's so much talk of people having grievances and everybody being so angry and we're going through a bit of a shift. And even prior to getting into this subject matter, we talked a lot about the new normal and how there are certain things that have completely changed and shifted, and we're not going to go back to the time before. We're not going to go back to something that we were once used to. And part of what I want to ask today, and I want us to really think about as I'm going through this, is ask yourself if some of the things that we used to do, some of the things that used to be normal, and I know I've asked this before, but ask yourself, were some of those things that we needed to get away from anyway? There are some parts of the old normal and the status quo and the way we used to do things that we frankly needed to get away from. I found it interesting. They were talking about how they were having a difficult time passing legislation, talking about, police protocols and chokeholds. And some guy, he kind of, chuckled. He said, you shouldn't have been doing that in the first place, Like, there are so many things in our society, and that's just one example. But he was like, this is, no nonsense. Like, I don't care which side of the aisle you're on. These are things that shouldn't have been happening anyway. And when we think about not only as a church, not only in our faith and our walk with God, things that we should be doing, the question that I want us to really ponder today is, because it matters, I want us to ponder, why did we do those things in the first place? See, there's a reason, even if it wasn't a good reason, there's a reason why certain things were done, even if they were wrong, even if they were bad. There's a reason why those things were acceptable. And as Christians, we have to be willing to challenge ourselves and ask ourselves, why is it that that was ever acceptable to me? Why is that something that was acceptable in the church? Why is that, when it comes to my own walk with God, looking back on it, it sounds ridiculous. It sounds like that should have never been something that was appropriate, but it was. And the question we have to ask ourselves is why? And the reason I said that matters, but the reason why that matters is because in order for us to grow in our faith, we have to be critical. We have to be humble enough to be critical and ask ourselves, how am I ever going to get better if I continue going about things the way that I used to, even when I know they don't work? The title that I've given, we're going to talk about this concept of collective atonement. The title that I've given today's lesson is Shoehorn. Shoehorn. Now, actually, I had a dream a few days ago that really was disturbing, and I'm not going to get too much into the dream, but this whole shoehorn thing will make sense in a little bit. once we get towards the back end of this particular lesson. But those of you all who are, I was thinking about this with my kids. My kids don't have any need for a shoehorn. I was thinking about when my kids were growing up, when they were really little, a few years back. Like, I remember, this was actually when we first moved here. William, he starts preschool, and he could tie a shoe. And the lady was like, wow, that's great. He can tie his shoe. Like, this is a big deal. And it's like, shouldn't kids know how to tie their shoe when they're four? But the fact is, now you got Velcro. You got all these different plastic shoes. And so not only is tying shoes kind of this, antiquated, outdated thing, but the shoehorn is really not that big a deal. Like, now shoes are so accessible and cheap. There was a time where it's like, you better not tear up those boots because you're not getting any new ones. You're going to have to make that work. And to the point where, it's like the shoe was kind of tight. Maybe you're growing really fast. It's like, you better make it work. They have all different types of shoehorns. It's something that, you typically put in and it's hard to get your foot in there, especially my grandmother used to have these. This is the first time I remember seeing it, because my grandmother would sit on the edge of her bed, slide, when she wasn't wearing her slides, she'd put her foot in there, and then she'd put the shoehorn in, but she kind of, because she wasn't going to bend over and bend down and, go through all those changes. No, you just put the shoehorn and you slip it in there. I'm doing this for the young people and the people who aren't familiar. Andrew's like, yeah, okay, duly noted. But a shoehorn is something that used to matter, but it's kind of antiquated now. I went to buy some shoes yesterday, as a matter of fact. I actually like this one because this is like you can still have the advantage of just being able to stand up and do it. They even have some that are longer than that. But I went to go buy some shoes yesterday because I have a couple of pair of gym shoes, and they're both worn down. One of them just to the point where I said, I'm not wearing these anymore. So I went to go buy some shoes, and they didn't have shoehorns. Like, you couldn't just buy one. I thought, maybe there's not that many, but there's got to be a couple of them. They were like, no, we really don't have much of a demand for it. They said, but you can go online. I'm sure you can get it on eBay or Amazon or something. Shoehorns are kind of a thing of the past. It used to have its usefulness. It used to matter. But, shoehorns aren't good or bad, but it is something that, we just never think about anymore. Even when you go out and buy shoes, you don't think about, man, I need to get a shoehorn also because my old one's worn out or, my husband broke it. No, nobody uses shoehorns anymore. It had a place and a purpose, but now there are other things. I'm going to come back to this idea of something being antiquated, because some things aren't as benign and neutral as a shoehorn. I want to start by looking at a passage where Jesus is teaching a very valuable, important lesson. There's several of them in here, and there's one I want to focus on. And normally, for the interest of time, I would abbreviate or just focus on it. But I want to read through this entire section here because it's very important that we get this. We're going to start in Mark chapter 7, verse 1. It says, the Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the traditions of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. Now, really important here, just a little note here. This was not done like how we're making sure that we're keeping social distancing and wearing masks. Like, this wasn't a matter of like we're doing this to keep out infection or making sure that we don't get sick. This was literally ceremonial. This was just done so that people could see it. It was done as a display, as a gesture, right? Continuing on, it says, so the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, why don't your disciples live according to the traditions of the elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands? He replied, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions. And he continued, you have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, honor your father and mother. And anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death. But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father or mother is korban, that is, devoted to God, then you no longer let them do anything for their father or mother. Thus you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And you do many things like this. Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them. After he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. Are you so dull? He asked. Don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? For it doesn't go into their hearts, but into their stomachs and then out of the body. In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on, what comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person. Jesus is making a lot of points. He's covering a lot of ground in just this small thing that we're looking at here when he talks about how it's the heart that matters. And yet what I want to focus on is when he talks about this ceremonial cleaning of the hands and these cleaning of the cup. You know, they had traditions. They had these rituals. They had things that they were going about doing. And yet, those were more important than what actually mattered. And I love how he said there, and you do many things like this. He said, because I don't want you to get sidetracked and think that I'm just talking about, you know, washing your hands and cups and things like that. No, you do many things like this. You have a lot of traditions and ideas and these behaviors that you hold on to that supersede what's even more important. I love he says how you're told, you're commanded. God expects you to honor your father and your mother. But instead, you put up a tradition that says, well, hey, actually, if you, you know, basically give this to the priest and take it to the temple and then he's essentially saying, you're outsourcing an expectation that God has given you. You're outsourcing that to the temple and saying, I've done enough. I've done my part. What's so important that we understand, and what I really want to look at today, and we're going to continue on the same thing, is that there are certain things as a church that we have to revisit and consider whether or not we're actually living up to God's expectations or whether or not we've been doing certain things for so long that they're normal, that nobody thinks anything of it. You know, I'm sure, you know, everybody didn't come in here and do the little ceremonial cleaning of the hands, but there are certain things that we just do without ever giving any thought to what should we be doing? One of the things that Andrew kind of went in today, he was talking about the truth, and the truth does not change, but how the truth, how we apply the truth, how we understand the truth does over time grow. Because there's a lot of things that we may know, okay, you know what, that's wrong, but we never give thought to why this thing is no longer working. You know, it's kind of like that shoehorn. Sometimes the shoe doesn't fit anymore. I bring this up because when I think about where we are today, where we are in our society and our communities right around us, as a church, we have to ask ourselves, are we meeting the moment that we're in? Are we actually being the church that God expects us to be? Because just like the Pharisees and back in this time, the teachers of the law, they were teaching the law. They understood the law, but they weren't actually meeting the moment that they were in. They were still doing all the things they had been doing, but it wasn't making a difference in anybody's spiritual life. It wasn't affecting anyone's faith. They were adhering to those rules and traditions that they had been doing countless times for years, but it wasn't making a difference in anyone's life. Jesus, in this example here, he's correcting, he's refining a very antiquated and incorrect doctrine, something that they had, a tradition that they had accepted as the law and what they should be doing. He's correcting this antiquated, outdated, useless tradition. It wasn't just a behavior thing, though. And it's important that we understand, it's not just behavior modification, but he points out it's the heart that has to change. That example he used of honoring your mother, honoring your father, you think about that, that's like one of those things that from the very beginning, God passed that down to his people. You honor your father and your mother. And yet, just like back then, as they kind of slowly slipped away from really truly honoring their father and mother, but just kind of outsourcing it, as a church, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that God wants us to be doing today that we've somehow managed to outsource? That we somehow said, well, you know what? I give in the offering or I support this. And there's a lot of things that we can forget that, no, actually, those are personal responsibilities that we have as Christians. These are duties that we were called to when we came to Christ. Have we actually accepted and embraced those things, or have we accepted certain norms and cultural things that are okay? This is an example of when it talks about different types of racism: structural racism, institutional racism, interpersonal racism, internalized racism, and all of them are different. And the reason why this matters is because sometimes people think, I don't really understand it. Now, this is important because the same thing can be applied to all of the other isms, right? There's different layers to it. You know, you might say, well, I'm not personally, you know, sexist. But there are certain things in our society that are sexist. There are certain things that are institutionalized that are sexist. There are all different types of ways in which, even if I personally don't feel a certain thing or think a certain thing, society has kind of, you know, basically put things in place that we unconsciously may participate in. This was a quote. God says, the reason why America isn't recovering from COVID-19 as quickly as other countries is because we are a country that values individualism over collectivism. Nobody here wants to do anything that is a minor inconvenience to them in order to protect their neighbors. Now, here's the thing. Forget COVID-19 for a second. Put that to the side. Can anybody really deny that this is true about the state of this country? Nobody wants to be inconvenienced. Nobody wants to have to defer their own wants and wishes and needs. I don't know who this guy is. I know nothing about it. But it doesn't change the fact that, much like Andrew was talking about, it doesn't change the fact that this is true. This is the state of our nation. We have to ask ourselves, if this is going to change, Is it going to have to change collectively? Do we as a church have to rethink how we go about our lives? Because if we're not careful, we become just like everybody else in the world. I want to look at an example of this. But first, there's a guy, this guy, his name is Joseph Andrew Deep, I believe it's pronounced Deepa, but he wrote a book, and I haven't had a chance to read all of it, but he is, I believe, Methodist, but he wrote a book called The Doctrine of Atonement for Building Human Rights in Malawi. Now, this guy, he talks about this idea that there were atrocities that went on in different nations in Africa, over in India, different places, and that in order for healing to take place, it wasn't just each individual had to look at certain things in their own life and say, I'm going to make atonement for this, and I'm going to fix the things that I individually did. But understanding that collectively, there has to be an attitude of atonement that groups, as Christians, we all have to engage in. There's another guy. His name is Josh Thoreau. He is actually a professor at the university. He was, anyway, at the time, University of Texas, San Antonio. And he talks about this idea of collective atonement. And very often we look at Jesus going to the cross as an individual thing. Jesus went to the cross and he died for my sin. And we forget that actually Jesus went to the cross, and not only did he die just for you, the individual, but he died for all of us. An example he gave would be if there was a company that was producing chemicals and then they had a chemical spill and they dumped a bunch of chemicals into some area, some water supply or something, and it got people sick, that they don't necessarily, each person within the, you know, corporation have to go out and do something, but lots of what they will do is they will make a collective statement of apology, and then they will make a collective donation or pay fines to pay for the damages that they cause. And then they will collectively go out and do things, and it may just be me representing the corporation, but it is being done for the whole. That very often we have to remember that collective atonement is much the same way. That we as a group, we as a church have to recognize what's going on around us and see that if we haven't been living up to God's expectations, then we collectively have to make some decisions to fix that. I want to look at an example of this because this may seem a little abstract, but right after we get through verse 23, we go into verse 24 and we can see the exact same thing, but I want to use this passage in Matthew chapter 15 because it, I believe, encapsulates this idea. Starting in verse 21, it says, leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying out, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly. Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, send her away, for she keeps crying out after us. He answered to the woman, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. The woman came and knelt before him. Lord, help me, she said. He replied, it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. Yes, it is, Lord, she said. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus said to her, woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted. And her daughter was healed at that moment. There's many very powerful things we can take out of this passage. One, this is one of the examples where Christ healed somebody without ever laying his hands on them. He let it be known that he had the power. He did not physically have to actually touch. When he did engage and heal people in that way, it was less about him having to physically put his hands on them and more pointing out that I'm not afraid to touch somebody who is sick. I'm not afraid to get dirty, as what they thought it was back then. But we also see here something that can almost go unnoticed and hidden, and something that we as a church have to really consider. us here in the Dover Church of Christ, we have to consider that this woman comes to him and says, have mercy on me. And the response that the disciples gave was, get rid of her, send her away. Why would they be sending this woman away? You know, in the version that you read in Mark, it talks about how this woman, she's Greek, this Syrophoenician woman. She is not one of them. She's not one of the Jews. That's why he says, hey, I was sent to the people of Israel. You know, I was sent to these chosen people. And she points out, she says, but even the dogs get the crumbs that fall down. So much of what we see here that we have to realize is that if it had not been for Jesus approaching and being willing to engage, and this woman pushing back what was normal, what was perfectly acceptable was to send this woman away. Nobody was going to challenge that. Nobody was going to say, okay, well, had she walked away when he said that, nobody would have thought anything of it. Because why? That's how they had always been doing it. But it was totally ineffective. It did not meet the moment that they were in. As a church, we have to ask ourselves, when we look around, when we think about the condition of the church, not even just here in Dover, but everywhere, when we see the church, we have to ask ourselves, is it effective? Are we really seeking and saving the lost? Are we actually bringing people to him? Are we doing things that matter, or are we just doing things because that's how it was always done? So when the woman comes up, well, you know what? Go take a line, go take a number and go stand in line. Or when somebody needs something, well, I'll just send them this way. Because that's what we've always done. Have we really asked ourselves, are we as a church being effective? Are we effective in doing the things that Christ asked us to do? We have a duty to atone not only for personal sins, but also for the sins of our collective culture. Our collective culture, our collective church culture is one where we are really good at coming to the building. We are really good at singing the songs. We know them. We're really good at making sure that we are responsible and we're dutiful and, you know, we give what we've decided in our heart to give. We pray for one another. We'll pray for anybody. But is that all that we need to be doing? Or do we need to look at the culture that has been established that maybe once upon a time it was effective? But do we have a need to do something different now? Do we have a need to do something now? Does the fact that we have so few young people in the midst, in our worship, in our lives, in our ministries, because we have so few people, is that just because young people just don't care about God? Or is it that we have neglected certain things for traditions and for things that are comfortable, for things that we just like to do? You know, I'll give you an example, because sometimes we look at that, and especially when I bring up young people, we think, well, I don't have any young kids, and I'm, you know, 70-something years old maybe. I'm 60-something years old. Why would a young kid want to listen to me? And yet we forget that there are, in fact, people in our midst who they have young children. And while they may not listen to you, how are you supporting and helping their parents? What are you doing to encourage and build up, maybe not your children or your grandchildren, because maybe they don't even live here, but what are you doing to help Dwight and Angela because they have children? What are you doing to really encourage the Gross children, the Huffmans? And I'm saying children, but they're not children anymore. You know, they're in their 20s. You know, they're getting older. What are we doing differently? Or are we just sitting there because the status quo and our traditions say, you know what, this is how we've always done it, and if it doesn't work, well, then that's okay. That's what's so ironic about the ceremonial cleaning. It wasn't even helping to clean anybody's hands. It wasn't even keeping anybody safe. They were just doing it. We have to be willing to ask ourselves, is what we're doing working? Is it really reaching those who need God the most? And if not, then what can we do differently? How can we meet the moment? You know, I talked about those shoes. I had a dream about these shoes. And, you know, I was kind of conflicted. I was confused. I didn't know why I was disturbed by it because it was just shoes. And one of these days I'll tell you the fullness of the dream. But I was talking to a friend of mine about it. One of the things that they said to me was they said, the fact of the matter is those shoes, you know, in the Bible when it talks about, you know, the feet of those who bring the message. He said sometimes your doctrine, your tradition, the things you're holding on to, sometimes they get too small and it's just time for you to put on some new shoes. You grow out of them. You grow out of shoes. I know some of you thinking, I haven't grown out of shoes in a long time, but me included. But when you get to a place where you've grown out of shoes, you don't just keep wearing those shoes. You seek to find new shoes. That's why they're uncomfortable. Many of us are uncomfortable with the condition of the church. We're not satisfied, but are we willing to expand and grow in our faith? Are we willing to actually say, you know what? I know this is how I've always done it. I know this is the way that we kind of get down here, but am I willing to do something different? Am I willing to make the changes necessary so that I'm not just complying to the traditions, but I'm willing to do something different so that God can actually be glorified through my efforts, more than just me being in compliance? A few questions I want to end with here. Does the way that you live for God reflect what's needed for today or the traditions that you were taught to live by? What's needed today? What can you do in the current times that we're in today? Because let's face it, many of you have been living a lot longer than me, and so you've gone through different changes. You've seen some different things. You can clearly say that today is not what it was 40 years ago or 20 years ago or even 5 years ago. In the case of right now, even 6 months ago. There's a lot of things that are different. Are we meeting the needs of today? Does the way that we live, does what we pray for, the things that we are asking God to help us with, is it meeting the needs of today? Or is it just our life looks like what it's always looked like? It meets the traditions and the standards that we've always adhered to. How uncomfortable are you in those shoes? Second question. Who in your immediate sphere of influence have you potentially overlooked because of outdated thinking? Who is it that may, because, you know, let's face it, this is that whole collectivism thing. You know, there are certain things that I can't identify with and I may not understand. It's not a personal thing for me. But there are other things that are. What are some opportunities that God is making available to you to reach somebody, to help somebody grow in their faith, to help somebody see God more clearly? But because of outdated, antiquated thinking, it never crosses your mind. Very often, you know, we feel like, hey, I'll work on this thing. Last week I talked about finding a cause or something that you could actually invest your time and resources into. But what if it's not something that you personally can do? Because sometimes we feel like, well, I can't do anything about it, so I'll do nothing. And maybe part of that change of thinking is, but I know that Dennis can, and so I'm going to help Dennis in whatever way I can, even if nobody even knows that I'm a part of that thing. Even if nobody knows that I am helping Charisse with whatever it is. I can't do it, but that person can. How many people are in our sphere of influence that we could be having an impact on, but because of the way that we've always done it, and we don't want to change, we don't want to change our routine. That's one of the things for me with the coronavirus that was so frustrating. I had a routine. I had my system. It was working perfect. I knew what I was going to do every morning. I get up. I'm on this devotional call with a bunch of guys, and then I, you know, pray, and then I, you know, take my supplements, and then I take Kendall and drop her off at school, and then I go to the gym, and then I come back, and I eat breakfast, and I had this whole thing, and then all of a sudden, schools are out, and everybody's in my house, and now my routine is off, and I still haven't recovered, and I'm mad because it's uncomfortable. Somebody asked this the other day, I mean, they said, what's something that's been positive about the coronavirus? What's something that actually has been good about it, if there's anything good to be found? I said, it's been good because of how much time I've been able to spend with my wife and with my kids. Now, granted, I wasn't thinking anything negatively, or I wasn't thinking poorly of my family before the coronavirus, but the fact is I had to get out of my system and my comfort zone to be able to realize how much I appreciated my family. And how much that meant not only to me as an individual, but even how it's helped my ministry, how it's helped me reach other people. Are we willing to look at the way that we've been doing things and see that there are people directly in front of me? There are not just neighbors in the generic sense. There are people living right next door to you that you could be having an impact on them. You could be helping them grow in their faith, helping them to, frankly, come into a relationship with God in many cases, but it's going to require you to get rid of some of that outdated thinking, whatever that outdated thinking is. What responsibility do we have as a church to collective atonement, and how can we make up for our past ineffectiveness as a ministry? Do you personally believe that we owe more? Do we owe more? And I want to park it here for just a minute or two, because think about how many years we've been coming to this building right here at 1156 Governors Avenue. And think of how many people have come through those doors, whichever one. How many people have been impacted? And now I want you to think of how many people have not been reached. How many people around us have not been impacted? You know, I was thinking of, I was kind of geographically thinking of how many people live close by, or at one point or another live close by here. And sometimes it can be really easy to think, well, you know, the Huffmans don't live too far away. They're just over the railroad tracks, or Steve and Janet are literally walking distance right around the corner. Like this neighborhood, this general area, this kind of their responsibility to meet the need, to meet the moment, to reach people around here. But we have to ask ourselves collectively, don't we need to make some changes? Don't we need to not just feel bad and apologize, but what is it that we need to do differently moving forward to not only say to this community, we are sorry that we have failed to meet the challenges and really reach out to as many people as possible, but we're going to do something, because being ineffective is no longer okay. It's not enough to say, well, hey, you know, we support the ministry, you know, we put in our money, and Bill, he does this, and there are different people who are functioning in ministry works, but collectively, what do we as a church owe? Don't we owe more to God? Don't we owe more to Christ than to just say, hey, I gave my money, or I showed up to a meeting? Because that's not meeting the need of today. What more do we owe God? How can we make atonement for so many years of, as a church, being the church here, God's representatives? How can we be more effective? How can we make up for the lack of ineffectiveness for so many years? And finally, what comfortable doctrine have I been taught that I need to reject in order to meet the moment that God has me in today? What comfortable doctrine? You know, I put comfortable in quotes there because you think about it, there are certain things that it was a tradition or it was something that, you know, we're just okay with it. You know, we're okay with it. I was thinking about one of the things. This is kind of an easy one where it's like, hey, you know, I just, you know, show up when I want to or I don't. Let's be honest. Some of us, we're happy that we have Zoom meetings and, you know, we can kind of look from our phone. And I don't mean to step on anybody's toes, but actually, if they're out there, let's just be honest. Because we understand that God's not holding us to a standard that says, well, if you miss on Sunday or if you can't be there on Wednesday, then that doesn't mean that somehow your salvation is lost. And we know that to be true, but have we gotten comfortable with the idea that, you know what, there's no standard that says that we do not forsake the assembly? Because it's one thing if you have to work, or it's one thing if you can't make it because you're sick, or because the coronavirus says don't show up. It's another thing altogether if in your heart of hearts you really didn't want to anyway. You really liked being able to pick and choose when you're going to be committed. And it goes on from there, like Jesus said, and there are many other things that are like this. We cannot be comfortable and meet the moment that we are in today. God is giving us an opportunity as a church to be different, to make atonement for years and years and years of ineffectiveness. I'm not even just talking about right now. I'm talking about back before Jonathan was here, back when Ron was here, way back. We have to reject this idea that we can be comfortable, that we can just adhere to the traditions that we've been carrying out. We come to church, sing a few songs, we take communion, we listen to the message, and we go home. And we read our Bible, we read a few verses, we pray. Occasionally we'll call somebody and encourage them. That is not meeting the moment. People are lost. People are hurting. People are confused. People need to know that you represent Christ and that you can help them get close to them. But it's going to require you to get out of your comfort zone. And part of that is rejecting. Rejecting. Literally saying, I refuse to accept these comfortable traditions that we've been adhering to. And as it's been a nice buzzword that's been going, reimagining, revisiting what this church can be, what this congregation can do to bring the message to those who need to be sought out. It doesn't even just stop with strangers and neighbors. We have families right here. We have families within our congregation. We have grandchildren. We have spouses. We have sons and parents. We need to reimagine, how is it that we can reach them? How is it that we can help them get a relationship with God? If we're going to meet the moment that we're in right now, this opportunity, we have to be willing to get uncomfortable and reject some of those old traditions that are no longer working because the shoe no longer fits.